welcome to a very special edition of the Fremantle Press podcast called Love to Read Local Radio. Love to Read Local is a week-long celebration that takes place from the 29th of May to the 7th of June. It's a statewide initiative to showcase Western Australia's many, many wonderful writers and illustrators and the books they create. As you'll note, I am not your usual host, Rebecca Higgy. My name is Emma Young. I'm a former bookseller, now journalist with watoday.com.au, and a writer of fiction too, in my spare time. My debut novel will be out in 2021 with Fremantle Press and is called The Last Bookshop. Meanwhile, I have a second manuscript waiting in the wings, and just this week I've started the first draft of my third book. My first guest today is someone who is well known to me, as he mentored me a little bit while I was writing the manuscript for my second novel. His name is Laurie Steed. Hey, Laurie.
Hey, Emma, how are you?
I'm good. It's nice to catch up with you.
Oh, right back at you. Yes, it's very nice to be here on this auspicious day.
So tell me a bit about yourself, Laurie, for the benefit of our audience. And, tell us about your career and about your latest book.
Sure. Well, my name is Laurie Steed. I'm a writer, a mentor, a creative writing teacher, and a short story assessor. My debut novel, You Belong Here, was published in 2018 with sincere thanks to the other guest on the program who we'll get to. She was a huge help throughout that. And my next book is called Nova, and it's a collection of stories, and it's sort of inspired by the idea that the people that we love and have loved are the stars in our sky. And so each story has a look at certain aspects of loss, of love, of resilience, and of finding faith in the strangest of places. So that's me.
Oh, wow. That sounds really fascinating. But you skipped very quickly past You Belong Here, Laurie. You didn't mention that it got recently shortlisted for the WA Premiers Awards.
Well, that's true too. I was very humbled and lucky enough to be shortlisted for the WA Premiers Prize for You Belong Here as well. And it did get some very kind reviews as well. So as far as debut goes, I was very lucky. I felt supported before it was published, and I found the right publishing house for it to be published. Mm. And then once the book was out in the world, I think the WA Lit community in particular was incredibly supportive of the book. And so every fear I'd had, as one does when one's about to have a debut novel out in the world, sort of vanished away fairly quickly when it seemed the world was not a place of ogres and monsters and harsh, severe critics, but actually filled with a bunch of literary professionals all keen to build this sector here in WA. So I was a very lucky boy.
Well, I guess what goes around comes around as well, because you do your best to kind of give back to the writing community in so many ways. So hopefully that's just...
Yeah, I guess it wasn't always that way. Initially, I had sort of felt quite isolated by the space, and it probably wasn't until I started spending time around established writers like Susan Medalia and Amanda Curtin and Michelle Michaud Crawford, and they sort of offered up their time and their generosity in really heartening ways, that I thought, okay, this is a way that one can be in the space. So while you could sit as a sort of lone wolf in the garret, those three women taught me a lot about working together and shared visions and the importance, I guess, of literary integrity as well in this place. So from that point on, I sort of made a decision, as I'm sure they did as well, to be there for the me that next showed up. So there'd probably be an emerging writer at some point who would go, wow, I'm feeling really daunted by this task ahead. And I don't
putting
even
my
know
hand up right
start.
Now.
Well, this is it. So a few initiatives came out of that, like the writing retreat at KSP, which you were selected for, and certain other avenues in which I could, show up for these writers. And so they're sort of spawned into, I guess, both my writing, with the second book due at some point in the future, and, this idea of being there for WA writers is typically where sort of isolated from the greater literary industry outside of WA.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you brought up the value of mentorship and working together, because we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. But first I want to ask about Nova, which sounds like a really awesome, fascinating concept for a collection of stories. And I want to ask why you've gone from like a novel format for your debut, why you've gone then onto short stories. It seems like a little bit of the reverse of what some people tend to do. I know that you love short stories. Like, do you want to sell me on why?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, I guess the other interesting thing to take into account when You Belong Here is that essentially that was something that began as 52 stories that I wrote for my PhD, some of which were closer to completion than others. And then over time, these 52 stories were sculpted together to become something more closely resembling a novel. And I enjoyed that process immensely. And yet there was part of me that ached to have the freedom for each of these stories to operate on their own. And certainly You Belong Here came from a single story I started called The Doppler Effect. And apart from the fact that Alex was an astronaut in that particular story, which changed greatly by the time we got to You Belong Here, there were a lot of the same familial underpinnings. So Nova was this idea that I could just write 19 to 20 stories, get them standalone, solid stories, and see if the world made more sense to me in a fragmented way. I definitely didn't think a lot about marketability and publisher realities when I came up with that rather genius idea. And so writing a short story collection is somewhat akin to if I went down to the Fremantle docks and got down to my jocks and said, hey, everyone, let's party. I'm sure I wouldn't get too many offers. But it spoke to me, and writing the work itself, working on Nova, just felt like an incredibly joyous sort of privileged space. And it sort of travels through time too. So one of my favourite stories in there is called Hannah Star Party. And that's about a family who goes up on their roof in search of Halley's Comet, which came around in the mid-1980s, to see if they can get a glimpse of this comet. And, of course, anyone who's had expectations or been waiting for something, it can always be quite a bit of disparity between what one thinks they're going to see when they gaze up at the stars and what eventuates in that time. So I guess the other thing about writing short stories again is it gets me humble again. It sort of makes me feel like I'm back to writing my first story again. And so it gives me a new ground on which to prove myself. And that's either complete lunacy or artistic genius. I don't think anyone's going to let me know which. But it was a hell of a lot of fun to write.
Well, I guess, you know, setting out to write with your eye on marketability only is basically the advice that nobody ever gave a writer. And so it's nice to hear that you started with joy, and you're only just setting out on the process of selling it anyway, aren't you? It's just kind of been finished recently, right?
That's right. So it's recently been finished, and then obviously it goes out to the big bad world. I think it's also important that I practice what I preach. So when I work with writers, I'm talking to them about narrative structure and talking to them about cohesion. So if I'm out there going, get on the marketability train and we can forget about all these basics, or at least we can sort of broaden our understanding of them, I'm a terrible teacher. So on some level, if I want to be seen seriously as a teacher of writing, as opposed to a teacher of, say, branding or marketing or anything of those things, then I really need to show up as that on the page as well. I need to say, I'm very serious about my writing. I want to be serious about your writing too. Because there are people that aren't me who are very good at helping writers become more visible and become more eloquent in this, in the form of social media. I'm not that guy. Like, I'm the guy, as you know as well, I'm the guy who will bust your chops. I'm the guy who will say, structurally, you're not hitting this point. And so for me, that's a real blessing, because I can exist in a slightly strange space with my own writing, because it's always a harder sell. But as a teacher of writing, it's very easy to do what I do, because no one can look at me and go, oh, my God, you're a total hack. Like, what are you doing teaching writing? Like, I work very hard at the craft. And I expect the same from my writers. So, as I say, it's not the road with that's got the jewelry encrusted on the pathway. It's more a dusty, dank little byway that goes down by the river. But it gets you there. It just takes a little bit longer, and maybe doesn't have quite as much of the fanfare.
Well, that's the main thing, and it feels like a really good point at which to introduce my second guest, because she has made a very tidy career out of publishing short stories. There certainly seems to be an appetite for hers. She is fellow Fremantle Press stablemate Susan Medaglia, who's, as I say, another very well-known member of the WA writing community. She and I both have new books coming out in 2021. Susan, hi, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Emma. Lovely to be here. Thank you. Sorry if I'm a bit croaky. I have no virus. I'm entirely virus-free, but yeah, nice to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to meet you, even if it's over a phone line.
So you want me to sum up my life? I guess, I've been an academic and a teacher for about three decades. I didn't actually start writing fiction until I was in my 50s. And I like to tell people this because, you know, it's the never too late mantra. Yeah. And I think I had the best preparation a writer can have for writing, which is reading, lots of reading of good books, because you learn so much from your reading. So I published three collections of short stories, and they've all been shortlisted for major literary awards. I calculated once that I think I missed out on about $80,000 because I didn't win any of it. But this is a serious point. It's actually, and Laurie will know this too, it's a real thrill just to be shortlisted because there are so many good books out there.
Absolutely.
Then I turned to novel writing, not because I think that writing short stories is an apprenticeship to writing a novel. I don't believe that at all. I think they're two very different beasts.
Yes, I think you and Laurie are both proponents of the idea that a short story is an art form in its own right.
Absolutely. And it's not a kind of truncated or abridged version of novels. It's got a very different aesthetic, and it has different challenges and different pleasures for readers. But I wanted to write a novel because I wanted to write about a character who changes, and that's very hard to do in a short story. So my first novel published with Fremantle Press was 2018. It's called The Art of Persuasion, and it's a comedy, it's a romance, and it's a political novel. So it's those three strands. I wanted to write something that mattered to me, which impelled me to write, really, which was about the plight of refugees. But when you're writing a political novel or a novel that has kind of political impulse, you have to be particularly careful not to lecture or harangue your reader and not to sound self-righteous. I mean, a writer should never insult their reader's intelligence anyway, but I think you can easily fall into it when you're writing a political novel. So then I thought I'd write a comedy as well. And so I guess it was about wanting to write something that was educative in that broad sense, but also amusing and entertaining. I also had years of students telling me that they were fed up with reading books that were bleak and gloomy and nihilistic. so it's actually nice to have something that's amusing, but that also makes your readers think. That was my aim.
It's funny because I read your book on the weekend.
Good.
And I enjoyed it thoroughly. And I must say, I also sat down there with the idea of, oh, okay, you know, I'm talking to Susan soon, so I want to get this book read. And I don't want it to be the kind of book that you just can't, you know, bring yourself to keep reading, and it takes forever and it's all depressing. And I absolutely was, you know, it was a real pleasure to read, and it was a comedy. And I actually would not, I see what you mean now that it's a cleverly disguised political novel, but I would not have even thought to describe it to anyone as such. So I think you absolutely achieved that aim there.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's I guess it's that idea of Oscar Wilde's idea that comedy is the genre that makes us think. So there's a difference between being serious and being solemn. So I wanted to write something that was serious, that was about issues that mattered to me, but also that, you know, entertained readers. I wanted to write a novel that could be, I guess, appreciated and enjoyed on different levels. So my family, for example, most of whom are not readers did read it and enjoyed it, but readers who have a more sophisticated literary knowledge will read it at a different level.
They'll
see the things that I'm, you know, the sort of ideas in different genre that I'm mucking around with and having
fun
with.
Yes, it's a book for book lovers. There's all sorts of little Easter eggs dropped through there that are a real pleasure for a bookworm.
The Laurie's point about marketability, someone once said to me about that novel, oh, you know, and it's got all these references to Jane Austen. That's a really good marketing ploy. And I was a bit taken aback because, you don't think about these things. Well, people like Laurie and I don't, because we're very naive. We just write for the pleasure of it. And you're just accidentally successful. And it is a joy to write. And it's an enormous privilege, most of which I owe to my husband, who trudged off to work and earned money so I could be a full-time writer. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that that's a privilege, because most writers I know have to have a day job.
Absolutely.
And just the novel that's coming out next year, along with yours, I must say, Emma, I love the title of yours, The Last Bookshop. It sounds apocalyptic.
Only mildly.
Only mildly. Okay, mild apocalypse is good. I think we've got enough of one at the moment, you know. So my new novel's called Everyday Madness. I'm very interested in irrationality. So part of what the book's about is the range of what one might loosely call madness. So I have one character who is diagnosed as clinically depressed, but I also have other characters who, despite thinking they're rational, actually lapse into quite irrational thinking and behaviour. There's the feeling of another character is an older man who loses his job. And that's about, he thinks he's going mad because there is that sense of utter deflation and loss of self-worth. Mm. So I'm interested in those things, how so-called ordinary, sane, reasonable people can get tipped over the edge.
Mm. It sounds like a really rich topic.
It's a bit darker than my first novel, but it's also got some laughs. So you have to have laughs.
It sounds fantastic. I can't wait. So when's that coming out? When in 2021?
Been really fortunate with Fremantle Press to have the wonderful Claire Miller as the promotional person, the marketing person, but also Georgia Richter, who's just a fantastic editor. She's worked really hard with me on this book and the previous novel, and that's what a good editor does. They make the book, they help to make the book the best it can be. So,
absolutely. And when's the publication date?
It's February of next year.
Ah, so we'll be very close together.
When's yours coming up? March, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's hope by that stage that society will be functioning more or less normally.
Yes.
And because as I'm sure you know, the arts industry has been decimated.
Yeah.
And I would love it for writers to not only to hold that book in their hands, but to do all the promotional events that are necessary.
Absolutely. And, you know, we are all looking into a winter of seclusion, so it might be a good time to talk about the process of mentoring and how that can help a writer, because, you know, a lot of writers will be in a position possibly to move some projects forward over the next couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you both have done a lot of mentoring, and it sounds like actually, Susan, you've mentored Laurie in the past.
Well, unofficially.
Did I get that right?
Yes, unofficially. Would you call it that, Laurie?
Look, I mean, if you were not my mentor and you passed on that much wisdom and guidance, then I think you probably deserve some sort of knighthood in replacement. I was incredibly
lucky. So no money changed hands, but she did the job anyway.
Well, I think the thing about Susan, and most people who've worked with her will tell you this, is she's an incredibly generous person. And not only is she, you know, she's a kick-ass writer, she reads, I don't know how she reads as much as she does, but she gets through an incredible amount of reading too. So it's really just like having a much smarter internet at your disposal if you have Fred all involved. So it's a very good gig.
I'm going to put that on my tombstone, a much smarter version of the internet. I like
it. In terms of what to expect and how to navigate the pre-publishing landscape, I was incredibly lucky to have Susan alongside me, because the hardest part of being a writer in that space, I found, was one's expectations mixed with one's anxieties, mixed with one's overcompensation to sort of execute and to be successful at every part of a bunch of things you've never known anything about. Mm. So Susan was incredibly helpful in also helping me navigate what I wanted out of all of this. And that's an incredible part that a mentor can play in saying, okay, here's this industry and here's what they want you to do and here's all their guidelines and all their expectations.
Mm.
It's your journey, though, as the author. So you want to be able to own it and to be happy with what's happening and with what you've created and see that it honors your vision in some way. Now, there are different versions of that, obviously, as you go forward, depending on what publisher you're working with or agents, et cetera. But I think it's really important that you're buzzed about it, even if it takes a while or even if it takes a long, long time or there are setbacks along the way. A mentor can kind of be the first person you call when you've gotten that incredibly heartless cold rejection, or they might be the first person you called when the editor calls from the publisher and says, yeah, we love this book, we want it. Mm. So it's almost like, again, it's like a juiced up bit of personal insurance that says you're going to have a hard road ahead. So you might want someone to check in with and someone who's been there to help you in this process. So I think it would have been difficult for me to mentor without being mentored by Susan, because you can't really mentor until you've had a really good mentor. And one of the greatest compliments I've got about my mentoring so far is writer who's also out in 2021, David Patali, saying he now wants to give back when he's in a position to do so after the publication of his book, because it says that what we're doing here matters in the respect of building it for the future too, in terms of mentoring.
So I want to go back to basics on mentoring, because I feel like a lot of writers need help and want help, but they don't know exactly what they need or in what form. And I know that you and Susan have both worked with Margaret River Press in the past. Mm. I think Susan was an editor. Is that right, Susan?
I've been an editor. I still do editing. I've been doing it for a long time.
Okay. So what's the difference between an editor and a mentor? Ooh. Laurie, you go first.
Okay, sure. I don't mind if Susan wants to start, but I'm happy to give my take on that. I mean, look, there will be aspects of reading through work and giving feedback on people's work while you're mentoring someone. That will be part of the process. But the actual process of editing can be incredibly intensive. And depending on whether it's development edit or a copy edit, it would not be fair to editors to suggest that a mentor can fully fulfill that role, because that can be on a much more micro level. Or it can be on a much more substantial level of saying, hey, this is what needs to be done here. And so a manuscript assessment is another part of that too, and that's also separate to mentoring. So a mentoring, from what I understand, is typically a longer arrangement where, say, you work with a writer for, say, a six-month period, for argument's sake, or even a year or even 2 years, and you work out what their goals are, what their vision is, and then you facilitate that. So that can mean meeting up every month. That can mean getting work sent through every session as well and discussing that work. It can mean talking about career opportunities, talking about submission protocols. It's sort of like being that one-stop shop for the industry process and for the creative process of the writer to get to where they want to get to. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you can have a mentor before you ever secure yourself a contract and an editor. Is that right?
I would argue yes. That's my take on it, is that in fact, it's a great ground or it's great space to sit in prior to that point of being picked up by a publisher, because an apprenticeship in writing is a long time in most cases. So
yeah, sure.
If you're seeking publication, it's also helpful to have that other person to bounce ideas off of. So you might also, I mean, I won't say any of them here because obviously you want to keep these things confidential, but some of the questions you get asked, you're really glad the writer asked you that question and didn't just go ahead and do what they said they were considering doing. So a lot of what I do also is they'll say, okay, this is my idea. And in your head, it's like, warning, warning, do not do what you're suggesting you're going to do. But when you talk to them, you say, okay, these are the issues you might come up with if you do that. So unfortunately, there's a dialogue about hustle, hustle, hustle in the literary industry too that can be unhelpful, because like I got asked one time, I did have a writer contact me about a competition I was judging and they were entering, and they sent me three stories and they said, hi, because you're the judge, I'm sending you the three stories I'm thinking about sending. Which of these is the best and which do you think will win?
Oh, dear.
And at which point I went, okay, again, I'd rather you hadn't contacted me because it pretty much makes you ineligible. But from a learning perspective, I can say you, one, it's about the writing and quality of writing. You can only give yourself your best shot. Two, never email a judge who's about to judge a short story competition, even if they're blind. There are a lot of unspoken things in the literary industry. And so a mentor is helpful in ensuring that writers get out of their own way sometimes too. But I'd also like to defer to Susan on some of this because she's been doing it a lot longer than I have.
Absolutely. Susan, so what is a mentor to you?
I think Laurie's put it really well, in the sense that a mentor doesn't necessarily come to you with a manuscript, and what you want to offer them is support for their project, advice about their project, you know, and psychological support. Editing is when you have the manuscript and you're either doing structural editing, so the big picture stuff, or copy editing, which is, you know, line by painful line. But I've been doing quite a lot of mentoring with the wonderful Centre for Stories.
Yes.
And their mentoring is specifically aimed at a publication. Mm-hmm. And so that's been fantastic. So the first person I mentored with the Centre for Stories was a hydraulics engineer called Yuat Alak, who he'd never written any fiction before in his life, but the Centre for Stories wanted to produce a small volume, which they ended up doing with four short stories called Ways of Being Here, and they were all of African origin, the four writers chosen. And Yuat, as I say, had never written any fiction before, and he wrote a story about a Sudanese child soldier, which was partly based on his family's personal experience. And he, to use that terrible cliche, he got the writing bug, and he was really raw. He was incredibly raw. By his own admission, he would say, you know, he had not much idea of what he was doing, but he ended up, you know, producing a wonderful story, The Thrill of Publication. He went on to write a much longer piece, which was subsequently shortlisted for the Hungerford Award and is now being published by Fremantle Press. So that, you know, that's really gratifying for the mentor. And I'm sure it's gratifying for the mentee as well. But so I've done other mentoring projects with the Centre for Stories. There was one called Bright Lights, No City, which is about young people growing up queer in regional and rural Australia. Mm. And again, none of them had any experience with writing, or minimal experience. But they, you know, they all ended up writing wonderful stories. I've mentored young people with mental health issues. That was through YouthLink, and their stories were very confronting, mostly therapeutic, but, you know, that's valuable in itself. I've mentored a couple of emerging writers for Wesley, the journal Wesley, other projects with Centre for Stories. I think the difference there, it's an unusual kind of mentoring because there is a publication guaranteed at the end of it. But generally speaking, as Laurie said, mentoring is really helping someone to shape their ideas, work up a project. They might, you know, they might come to you without even having a manuscript. Right. But editing is the hard yards of trying to make the book. And if I could say one thing about editing, I think editors, they're invaluable, and they tend to be invisible. So if a book gets bad reviews, you might see the comments, you know, this book needed a good edit. Mm. And the reality is that the editor might have twisted him or herself inside out to try and get this book to be a better book. But at the end of the day, the writer has the final word. And unless their material is defamatory or libelous or offensive in some way, you know, the writer does have the final word. But if a book gets really good reviews, and some of that is attributable to the editing, again, the editor doesn't get acknowledgement for that. So they work behind the scenes, I think.
And so does a mentor, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it's enormously gratifying. I love editing. It's bringing your critical faculties to bear on writing. I find I'm much better at editing than I am at writing my own books. You know, I don't know, Laurie, if you have this, but I can see problems in other people's work. I know how to fix that. I can do that. I look at my own and I can't see the problems some of the time.
The process of manuscript assessment is, I think, as you say, like editing, mentoring, all of this, but all of that is quite joyous. But there is a certain level of mastery that one can have when looking upon someone else's work. Yep. That's incredibly difficult to pull off in your own writing.
Yep.
And it's amazing, that disparity, because you would figure that as you get so razor sharp at spotting these things and becoming a sort of a story mechanic, that it might flow on effortlessly to one's own work. But in fact, there's always that dissonance of distance, and you go, oh, okay, I'm much closer to this now. And I'm struggling to see that bigger picture that I saw so easily when I picked up another person's manuscript. But I agree with Susan that the joy at seeing your mentees, you know, for lack of a better word, succeed is just so exciting. So, you know, whether it was yourself, Emma, you know, being sure it was for the Fogarty, or obviously Mel Hall was in the mix there as well, who I also worked with. It's just been incredibly exciting to see these writers find their next part of the journey. And so I know for me, like 2021 is sort of this year where I have my hands pressed together in gratitude as I watch these people that I've, you know, that have worked so incredibly hard to get where they got to. And that's the other thing that people don't talk enough about, is they go, oh, you know, maybe they got picked up because it was marketable or because it hit a zeitgeist moment. No, most of these writers just worked incredibly hard. Mm. They deferred to people who gave them advice and guidance, and then just worked beyond what would be expected. So there's this level of, like, entitlement that comes with an emerging writer sometimes, where they go, I've submitted the same story 59 times and no one wanted it. I shall now submit it another 41 times because I'm getting ahead as a writer. And you go, no, that's not how this works. The idea is that we get better and we develop. So I guess the other thing that's really exciting about mentoring now is that there are these initiatives that Freo Press is coming through, the Four Writers Program as well. So not only are you helping writers to work with their work and their writing, you're seeing opportunities that they can capitalize on. And so initially, what might have been reluctance from an emerging writer going, oh, could I even go for that? Do I even have a shot? Has been sort of designated specifically for a WA writer to step into and take that and run with it, which is so exciting. And what Susan said about Caroline and the Centre for Stories I would second, and what Susan said about Westerly and their mentoring program, having worked in both of those programs, you get an awful lot out of mentoring. And I'm sure the people you mentor get an awful lot too, but it would be remiss not to suggest that you don't get an incredible reward from working with these writers.
Yeah, and it's also what interests me too is the range in emerging writers. So you'll get some. I've had experience with emerging writers who think they're already, you know, bound to win the Booker Prize, but then there are others who have no idea how good they are, and they are genuinely. Almost self-lacerationally modest, you know, and it's actually hard to convince them, hey, this is really good writing. So that mix is quite interesting, I think.
And different personality types too as well. Like you meet these incredible, in terms of their life experiences, through the mentoring program centre, you meet people from all kinds of different backgrounds and different, you know, realities. So I think on that level, it's super exciting to see WA, I guess, get more vibrant in terms of the types of writing we're seeing coming up and the styles and accepted sort of modes that perhaps wouldn't have surfaced were there not these programs coming through and bringing these voices to life.
Well, that seems like a really good point at which to talk about the WA books that we can get excited about coming out. We know that this COVID-19 outbreak has been really tough on the arts community, and it really has affected authors, like Susan, you were saying, with so many events and book launches getting cancelled. And it's been hard on our booksellers too, with a drop in business. But, you know, we can also tell a positive story here. A lot of those local booksellers have taken up this challenge and they're launching free home delivery and they're encouraging people to read local and ring in for local authors' book suggestions. And so I thought you guys have students, for want of a better word, more mentees, whose books are coming out. You both would read a lot of local authors. So with all that in mind, I was hoping that you could each recommend a few titles for us to read while we're hunkered down this autumn and maybe winter too. Even books recently published that you've had a hand in, or books that you've had a hand in that are going to be published soon, or really, you know, anything by a WA or Australian author that you're excited about?
Well, I have two in particular. One has already been published, and that's Catherine Noske's novel, The Salt Madonna, which I think is wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful.
Heard a lot about that one.
I first read Kate's manuscript when it was a PhD thesis and gave her some feedback on that. It's quite different from that original version, but it's a fabulous book. I would really recommend it. And the other one, there's a Josephine Taylor's forthcoming novel, Eye of a Rook, and Fremantle Press is bringing that out in November. I've worked really closely with Jo on this novel for about 4 years. She was already a really gifted writer before we started working together. And I first met her at a writer's retreat I was running, and I thought, this person really knows how to write. She'd already published academic articles, but I think she'd had some short stories published as well. But anyway, it's a terrific book about a very confronting subject, but it's very subtle, very complex, beautifully written. So I can thoroughly recommend those two novels.
Oh, that's really exciting to hear, because Josephine is a fellow member of the Four Centres Emerging Writers Program that I'm also part of.
That's right,
really nice. I've sort of heard her pitching this book quite a few times over the past year or so, so it's really exciting to hear that it's coming out and that it's so good. What about you, Laurie?
For me, I guess 2021 is going to be a bumper year for Fremantle Press, and certainly for the Four Centres Writers Program and the KSP Writers Retreat I've run over the past couple of years. So it'll be really exciting, obviously, to see the last bookshelf. I'm going to be pretty much
stoked
to see that. And first one in line for that by Emma Young at Quality.
For the plug, Laurie.
No worries. I'm also very excited about Mel Hall's Shapes, which is coming later in the year, I believe, and David Allan Patali's Lake of Summer. So they're all writers that I worked with through the KSP Writers Retreat Program. And the other one I would be pretty excited about, also from Freo Press, is Zoe Delul's The Night Village. Now, I didn't work with Zoe on that novel, but I have
The Night Village, on, did you say?
The Night Village, yeah.
Cool title.
I know, right? She rocks. And I didn't work with her on that novel, but I did work with her on two short stories, both of which were just shortlisted for the Newcastle Writers Award, which is very cool. So we'll find out in due course how they go. But it's been great to sort of see Zoe grow as a writer. And then finally, I've worked for Writers Victoria for about 5 years teaching their online short story clinic. And there's a writer called Wayne Marshall who was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards in 2019. And then in February this year, released his debut collection, Shirl, which is quite the ride if anyone's in for an interesting sort of quite a humorous take on all kinds of things. Wayne, one of those writers that I, similar to Susan with Joe, the moment he submitted a story, I thought, holy moly, this guy's voice is in a different planet. Like he's looking at the world in a really fresh and interesting way. So to see all those stories that first were submitted through the clinic be published in a collection and one shortlisted for the Vic Prems as well was incredibly rewarding. And he's also a super nice guy. Had to work his way through cancer as well. So he's had an interesting time in his life outside of writing. And yeah, it's just going to be it's already a bumpy year this year. And next year feels like a year of so many great WA debuts that you probably won't see me out of the house for a little while as I work my way through.
You just continue
titles.
Your self-isolation.
That's right. Everyone's like, you can go outside, man. And I'm like, no, I've got so many books to read.
Is Wayne Marshall the guy who you've just blogged about who's recommended his top five short stories?
You nailed it. That's exactly the guy. And we also work together on a sort of anonymous long lister. Well, not anonymous anymore, but I have been a long lister and judge for the Peter Carey Short Story Award for about 3 years. And he's one of the organisers of that award and also has the green thumb of approval from Peter Carey, which is a pretty good get if you can get that. So one of my most enjoyable journeys last year was travelling out Bacchus Marsh Way to meet with the organisers of that and talk through how it's all going and the journey thus far. So, you know, Wayne had quite a long journey with this book and all success is well deserved. And speaking of the Vic Prems, the only other book is Rhett Davis, whose book, Davis's brother, also has a book on the way, although I'm not sure if that's been officially signed up. So if you're a reader of quality Australian fiction, you're pretty much in the buzz zone of really exciting times of new fiction coming through, so I just can't wait.
That's fantastic. And I will note as well, just in a funny bit of synchronicity, one of Wayne Marshall's top five short stories that he's recommended on your blog, Laurie, it's a story by Joyce Carol Oates.
Yes. Oh, that was actually, Emily Paul who recommended that one.
Was it Emily Paul? Yes. Okay, so it's the blog post before last. But that Joyce Carol Oates story is actually featured in Susan's novel, The Art of Persuasion.
Of course it is, yes. That's a very, and then there's another nice piece.
Where are you going? Where have you been? It's
that's right.
One of the most chilling stories I've ever read. I used to teach it, and young students who were not particularly interested in stories, it got them every time.
Between the two of you.
She does creepy really well.
The two of you, you got me to read that story, so it's very well done.
Well, there's another interesting piece of synchronicity with Emily Paul on that particular story is obviously that one of her collection, Well Behaved Woman, is Dynamite, but she has a story, a particularly chilling story in that collection called From Under the Ground, which taps into some of the fears around, you know, the Claremont serial killings at that time. Mm-hmm. And so if there was a successor to Oates or someone who was willing to step up into that space of a quality short story writer, I think Emily Paul's well on the way too. She's certainly come leaps and bounds since I first met her all those years ago. So,
That's a good recommendation for Emily.
Can I put in one more plug too?
You can.
Thank you. It's a book with which I had nothing to do with, but it's a collection of short stories by West Australian writer called Bindi Pritchard.
Yes,
Fabulous Lives. And it is a stunner. It's an absolute stunner. And Bindi's one of these kind of impossibly nice people, which I also like. It's always a disappointment when you love someone's work and then you meet them and you think, oh. Anyway, one shouldn't make these naive judgments, but it's a really, really stunning collection of stories, and I can recommend them. I know my local bookshop, the Lane Bookshop, has been really pushing it, and they're getting lots of good feedback from readers. So,
yeah. I mean, and Bendy is an insanely nice person. I was at her launch for Fabulous Lives, and she was at the door. So she was literally greeting every person as they came through with a hug. And I just thought, that is such a good idea for a launch. I can't believe I didn't think of that. Like, this is an opportunity to see everyone you love come through a door specifically for you to celebrate your book. And so I think everyone in the room that night sort of felt like they were incredibly lucky to be celebrating that with her.
Yeah, and that's if we could make a prediction... If we make a prediction, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of writing about the virus. So we had sci-fi and we've had cli-fi, books about climate change, and now we're going to have vi-fi. So there's going to be a lot of books about the epidemic, I think. There's many stories to tell.
But for now it's all about escapism. And on that note, I can probably add one as well. Dervla McTiernan, the Perth author Dervla McTiernan, I recently read her new book, The Good Turn, and that is such escapism because it's set in Ireland where it's pouring all the time and it's detective. So it's completely something that removes you completely from Perth, and it's a cracking story. So that was a really good one too.
Excellent.
So it's been really great to connect with you both and also with the listeners out there, each in their own, each staying firmly within their own dwelling. It's been a really nice reminder, I think, that, you know, these books that we're talking about can really bridge the divide, even though we can't all be together at the moment. So we can still feel a connection to other people and other places. So thank you guys so much for talking to me about books and about mentoring and inspiring me to do some local themed reading. Thanks so much for your time today, Laurie and Susan.
Thanks very much, Emma.
You're most welcome.
And thank you, listeners, for being part of Love to Read Local Radio, which is brought to you by Fremantle Press with support from the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. Love to Read Local, I'll tell you again, is a week-long celebration of WA's numerous outstanding writers and illustrators, brought to you by Writing WA. And you can check the show notes for more details about Writing WA, as well as for information on getting hold of any of the books that we've mentioned today. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to the Fremantle Press podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your favourite podcasts.